And my thanks to the organisers for inviting me to this very nice meeting. I flew in from the UK yesterday. I hope jet lag won't stop me being reasonably coherent. Yes, I want to very much emphasise the word towards in the title, but I think I want to offer a sort of personal perspective about where contextuality is going and why it might be useful to have what we might call some kind of theory of contextuality. So obviously, we have the sort of landmark result that we're commemorating in this workshop, the Cochin-Specker theorem, and showing that quantum mechanics is contextual, the issue of convincing experiments for this, which was being discussed this morning. And that's the sort of fundamental point. And then obviously also there's been a lot of discussion about philosophical consequences, philosophical interpretations, how we should understand quantum mechanics in the light of contextuality, and indeed the shape, its import for the shape of possible future physical theories. In recent work, we can see at least beginnings of what we might call a structural theory of contextuality, seeing it as a mathematical structure that of some generality and with a range of applications. So we see general mathematical settings in which contextuality can be defined and general structural results which apply both to quantum mechanics and beyond. And there are a number of approaches to setting this up. Some of them are represented at this meeting. There are others as well. So in that sort of general setting, so having a general idea of what contextuality is obviously important, because if we want to meaningfully say that quantum mechanics or nature is contextual, we need to know what contextual means. We've already heard some definitions previously. But when we do a good job of that, we find a general notion that appears in many situations, in fact, and not only in even if we are not only in quantum mechanics. It turns out the same mathematical structures appear in many ways of putting information together that we come across, for example, in computer science and elsewhere. A second point is recognizing that contextuality is not a single undifferentiated phenomenon, but there's a hierarchy of strengths of contextuality, which I think is an interesting point. Obviously, there's also the issue of quantifying contextuality and of seeing contextuality as a resource in particular for various information processing tasks. This is something there'll be several talks about here, and I'll be also saying a bit about that. And in particular, using contextuality as a resource to gain quantum advantage in those information processing tasks. And this may all, this sort of goes, you could say, in the direction of applying or using contextuality, but we could say that as quite a puzzling and challenging phenomenon, maybe the best way of understanding it is to see how it can be used. And that will lead us to a deeper understanding of what the phenomenon is and what its consequences are. So I do actually believe that to be the case. All right, so I want to describe the particular approach I'll be taking, but being as light as possible on the technicalities. I think in many ways it's very close to the approach that Professor Cochin was describing this morning, but with a little recognition of a piece of structure which turns out to be very useful for us, which is that we have, as we heard, a family of probability distributions ranging over contexts, but there is structure to the way that these distributions vary over the context. In fact, there's a functorial structure, and mathematically this is very important, and we'll see some of the ways that can be used. Without actually talking about functors. So our general setting is what we call a measurement scenario. This is in the same general spirit as the scenarios we heard about, in for example, in Adan's talk with the graphs. But there's, again, a little bit more structure here in that we find it useful to distinguish between the measurement labels and the the variables we can measure, which fall in this set X, and the set of values or outcomes that we can get when we measure those variables. And the way that we represent when compatibility or when measurements can be performed together is by a family of subsets, which say exactly, so two things lie in the same subset, the same context, as we call it, when they can be measured together. This is, it could be made more general yet, but this is already sufficiently general to cover a huge range of situations. And what we call an empirical model, meaning the kind of thing where we can measure these variables and get statistics from, we can observe, and which we can also produce by applying the predictions of a physical theory such as quantum mechanics. So an empirical model relative to such a scenario is assigning a probability distribution for each context, so a family of probability distributions indexed by the context on the outcomes of getting all the possible outcomes for the measurements in the context. So such a joint outcome is represented naturally by a valuation, a map, which assigns an outcome to each variable in the context. So we get this family of probability distributions. But it's very important that this is not just a family, but it's coherently related and itself has an algebraic structure. So just to put it in what looks like more familiar notation, if this is the set of variables in a context, then we could write this assignment of probabilities for a joint outcome as something like this, which may look more familiar, given that the we've chosen these measurements or these variables to perform, the probability of getting a corresponding outcomes for them is given is exactly what the empirical model tells us. So we're keeping the structure of the family of the indexing set of contexts rather than flattening things out into assignments to all the possible events. This is an apparently small but very useful distinction with other representations, which turns out to be very useful. In particular, we have a natural notion of restriction from a larger context to a smaller one, which for these probability distributions just amounts to marginalization. And we have a condition that we can put on these models, which is that they agree on the overlaps of the context. So this is the sense in which a variable that occurs in two different contexts should get the same distribution regardless, if we look at it in isolation, regardless of which of the larger contexts we measure it in. And this can be seen as a generalized form of the no-signaling principle, familiar from non-locality theory. In fact, so firstly, it exactly specializes to that principle if we take the case of this for the ordinary kind of Bell scenarios, which fit perfectly as particular cases into this setting. And secondly, in generality, if we interpret the measurements by observables which commute if they're in the same context, then this is always satisfied by quantum mechanics, this compatibility property. On the mathematical side, this restriction operation, which is really saying that we have some kind of pre-sheaf that's varying in a coherent algebraic way over the context, is giving also a kind of geometric or topological aspect to the picture. And we see this when we come to how non-contextuality looks in this setting. It's the existence of a global section. So we think of this local information that we have over the context, and then non-contextuality would be existence of in this case, a joint distribution which restricts or marginalizes to give us back all the empirically directly observable probabilities. So this is taking local information and seeing how we can piece it together into global information. There's a nice pictorial way of seeing that, which begins to let us see what the natural sort of topological structure is here. And I'm exemplifying it here with essentially the well-known Hardy paradox construction, Lucien Hardy's paradox construction, which is something which is in this hierarchy of contextuality. It's actually, on the one hand, a probability-free demonstration of contextuality or non-locality, if you will, but at the same time is of an intermediate strength between Bell's theorem and the Coach and Specker theorem. So here is the Hardy model where I've simply put ticks and crosses to say is possible, i.e. has probability greater than zero, or is impossible, has probability zero. And we can depict this in the following way. We have a sort of base space, just a discrete base space of the variables we can measure. Alice's variables A and A prime, Bob's variables B and B prime. We put edges between them if the measurements can be performed jointly. So the idea is Alice can make a choice of measurement, Bob can make a choice of measurement, but Alice or Bob can only make one measurement at a time. So there's no edge between A and A prime. And above each of these variables, we put in a fiber, we put the possible values that the variables can take, which are here just 0 or 1. And we now put edges to represent those outcomes that are deemed possible, that have a tick in the corresponding row, corresponding entry in this table. So you see, in this combination, all joint outcomes are possible, whereas in this one, where we're measuring A prime and B, only 3 are possible, so we only have 3 edges. Similarly, on this face and on the final row, we have just those 3 edges. Now, this sort of discrete bundle, what is it telling us? Well, it's telling us essentially everything about the model in a very direct way. So the first thing we notice is that every edge can be extended. If I have a local possibility here and I have an edge in one direction, I also have an edge that connects me to some possibility here in this context. So possibility is invariant for a given variable, does not depend on which larger context it appears in. I don't know if anyone can see what principle this corresponds to. It's actually exactly the compatibility principle that we were describing earlier, but now at the level of possibility. So mathematically, that's exactly what it is. It's this coincidence of marginals, but now at the level of possibility. So we can always extend paths. But then we can ask, can we find one of these global assignments of values which would all be consistent, which would uniquely assign a value to each variable and be consistent with the model? And we see that in this diagram, it is possible to do that. If we start, for example, with here, then we can go all the way around and get, as it were, a univocal path which assigns a value to all the variables consistently with the models, consistently with the constraints of the model. But can we always do this? Well, if we happen to start with this edge, then we can continue and continue and continue, but we can never get back to where we started in a single path. We could try going around the other way, but of course we're not going to do any better. And this, in a nutshell, is exactly the proof of Hardy's paradox. All the relevant information is there. Some local section, some observable event, cannot be extended to a global assignment which would explain it. And therefore, the behavior of the model is not entirely explicable by such a thing. This is a stronger property than the usual probabilistic argument, in fact. So this was saying that some events can be extended and some can't. There's a yet stronger notion, which says that there is that no local event can be extended to a global assignment. And this is also a familiar thing. So here is the PR box, perhaps not as you've seen it before, but exactly following the same conventions that we described earlier. So here are the possibilities and impossibilities of the PR box. The probabilities, by the way, carry no information because they're uniquely determined, given that it's a no-signaling model, under the constraints of no-signaling. And you see that the bundle is exactly a kind of discrete version of the Möbius strip. And wherever you start, you will never be able to form a closed path that gets you back to where you started with unique values to the variables. In fact, one can easily show that this is isomorphic to a standard depiction of not of the classic Lyer paradox, but of an extended Lyer paradox, where a statement S1 says that S2 is true, S2 says that S3 is true, and S3 says S4 is true, and S4 says that S1 is false. It's exactly that. We cannot propagate the values along the local constraints in a way that's globally consistent. So this is strong contextuality, where no event can be extended to a global assignment. So in the sort of picture, the usual kind of picture with the non-contextual polytope and the then we see that we have the probabilistic contextuality, which extends beyond the non-contextual case, and those models that, that can at most be shown to be probabilistically contextual lie in the relative interior of the contextual part. Logical contextuality, the points will lie on the faces, and strong contextuality, the faces consisting only of contextual points. And there's a yet stronger notion of all versus nothing argument abstracting from a phrase due to Mermin and abstracting from one of his arguments. So in terms of the salient examples, so the original Bell or CHSH argument, the Hardy construction, GHZ construction, and the Mermin all versus nothing constructions illustrate and exemplify a strict hierarchy of logical notions, which can be defined in full generality in the simple setting that I was just describing. Okay, so so now I want to talk about some steps towards or contributions to developing a general theory of these phenomena, hopefully with applications in quantum information processing, among other things. So I want to talk a little bit about cohomology of contextuality, how this topological structure that we've hinted at with this bundle diagrams really is a salient structure, and we can find, in a non-trivial way, a cohomological characterization of a large class of examples of contextuality. Then I want to discuss briefly some results on characterizing which states can achieve the various levels of the contextuality hierarchy. Some interesting results about characterizing all versus nothing arguments for stabilizer states. In fact, a complete characterization of that. I'm not going to talk about that, but Giovanni Carew, who's here, will be presenting a poster on that in this workshop. I'll also say a little bit about the quantum monad and how we can, which will relate to several of the themes that we heard about this morning. I'm not going to talk about quantitative measures and resource theory for contextuality because Shane is going to talk about that later today. But I think these various things show a variety of methods and a number of at least modest steps towards a usable and hopefully useful theory of contextuality. Okay, so let me begin with cohomology. How am I going to present cohomology in about four slides? Well, I'm just going to tell you what I need to tell you, hopefully. So the original paper was with Ruby Barbosa and Shane. So what do we need to know? We can take this data of a contextuality scenario that we were describing, and we can describe in the way that one does in that following the routine of algebraic topology, a kind of a combinatorial model to which we can attach cohomology. So we have zero cochains, which are tuples of element families indexed by the context, where each such element is a Z-linear combination of these local assignments. Why Z-linear actually could be any commutative ring. Essentially, the idea is we have to introduce additive structure, the structure of an abelian group, in order to be able to get going with cohomology. When we go up the dimensions, we go from having single elements to just indexed over contexts to elements indexed over pairs of contexts. And now it's a Z-linear combination of sections which are on the of assignments which are on the intersection of the pair of contexts here. And for two cochains, we're looking at triples and assignments on the intersection, the three-way intersection. So those who are familiar with Czech cohomology will see how this is related to that. But we can just see it as it is. And we can go to higher dimensions, obviously, we'll only need these. And these are then organized together into a cochain complex where we have maps between them that raise the dimension. And these can be described quite simply. So that at the zeroth level, we take an element, one of these singly indexed elements, and turn it into a doubly indexed family by taking differences. So the value here is just the difference of the thing we get at I restricted to the intersection of I and J, and this is the subtracted from that one. And at this first level, we get this thing which gives us translates into what's quite widely known as a co-cycle condition. if you think about when this vanishes, it vanishes exactly when Rij plus Rjk equals Rik. So there's a kind of transitivity idea built into it. Now, because the co-boundary maps, the co-boundary of a co-boundary vanishes, which was something that John Wheeler liked a lot. So the co-boundary maps, if you do successive ones, they vanish, which tells us that the boundaries are the images, and the co-cycles are the kernels of these maps. And because of this condition, that tells us that every co-cycle is every co-boundary is a co-cycle. So the interesting things happen when we get co-cycles that are not accounted for by co-boundaries. And this gives us the sort of the machinery of homological algebra, lets us define these cohomology groups as the quotient groups. It's easier to give an intuition in the dual case of homology, where you think of co-cycles as cycles, just which bound some volume in a given dimensional space. And then some of those arise by taking the boundaries of higher dimensional elements of a simplicial complex, say. And the ones that are genuine holes in the structure are those that don't arise from by being the boundary of some higher dimensional things in the simplicial complex. So it's the holes we're interested in detecting, and that's what homology does for us. And up to duality, that's what these groups are doing. But in our setting, they give witnesses for obstructions to gluing these local sections together. In other words, witnesses for contextuality. And in fact, it's easy to see that the zero co-cycles are those families, singly indexed families, which are compatible, meaning that they restrict, that all these restrictions are the same. It's a sort of the level of the cohomology. It's a version of the compatibility condition that we saw earlier. And another bit of the machinery tells us that we can restrict attention to a particular local section by using the gadget known as relative cohomology. We just zero out a particular context where we want to focus on. And this is what's going to let us address the problem, when can you extend a local section to a global one, which, as we saw, corresponded to these notions of contextuality. And now we can use the machinery of cohomology to something that pops out of the machine, a map, which for every local section gives us an element of this first cohomology group, such that it gives us a witness for whether or not the local section could be extended to a compatible family, i.e. a global section. A witness, it vanishes if there's no obstruction to giving a non-contextual explanation for this local assignment. Which means that if it doesn't vanish, the empirical model is logically contextual at S. And if this holds for all local sections, then the model is strongly contextual. So we get a cohomological witness in this fashion. This is a computable invariant. If you start with a finite scenario, everything can be, we can compute with things effectively, which provides a sufficient condition and a witness for contextuality. I should say that the condition is not in general necessary. There are false positives, things that look contextual but aren't. And that's because we've had to go to Z-linear combinations of assignments. So we can get fake things that arise because they're Z-linear combinations. This is the fact that, in general, homology, cohomology gives us computable invariants, so it doesn't always give us the precise answer. But in very many cases, it does. So as I said, in case there are any experts present, we're using the Czech cohomology of a pre-sheaf, and that bit of machinery I was talking about is the connecting homomorphism of the long exact sequence. So here's the snake lemma that does the job for us. Moving on. So what can we do with it? Well, unless anyone had any questions at that point. I just wanted you to know that there was something honest going on. Not pure snake oil, or just the snake lemma, not snake oil. Okay, so we've done computing cohomological witnesses for contextuality for many examples, GHZ, many Koch and Specker constructions, Peres-Mermin square, and other things. And we've also shown that, and we also know that wherever we get one of these witnesses, that certainly the model, that we certainly have strong contextuality present, or if it's that we've shown there are obstructions to extending every section. And we've also shown that for a large class of arguments, all the all versus nothing arguments, they are in fact detected by contextuality, by this cohomology invariant. So we don't have a complete characterization, but already something that shows that quite a lot can be done. And what's nice is that these ideas have led to a number of interesting developments by other researchers. So Frank Ruhmann, in his thesis, has adapted our ideas to the setting of effect algebras using a cyclic cohomology introduced by Kahn originally. Robert Rausendorf is very actively working and has a recent paper with Stephen Bartlett and others on pursuing the cohomological approach to contextuality using group cohomology with applications in measurement-based quantum computing. And recently, there's a group in Hanover using this approach to study multipartite entanglement monogamies with the aim of getting results on ground state problem for many-body quantum systems. So I think there's a number of interesting developments in progress. Okay, that was the first topic. I've just given a lightning review of it. If you want to read more, then there are these papers that I mentioned. So this one, and actually one on contextuality, cohomology, and paradox. Now, the second thing I wanted to say a bit about was this state characterization problem. So now we're putting away these those gadgets, and we're going to look at the question of how we quantum realize an empirical model. So obviously we're going to have measurements corresponding to the labels, and we're going to have a state to generate the probabilities via the Born rule. Given that, it's, I think, very natural to ask the question, for a given state, what is the highest level of contextuality we can reach as we range over all finite sets of measurements? And for various fairly obvious operational reasons, it's finite sets of measurements that we're particularly interested in. So in particular, we can ask for which states can we find measurements yielding a logically contextual empirical model, i.e. a Hardy paradox, and the same question again for strong contextuality and all versus nothing arguments. So I'm going to summarize some answers to these questions which we've gained so far. In the case of all versus nothing arguments, as I said, Giovanni has a poster on this. In the case of logical contextuality, there's a fairly complete answer, at least for qubit states. Lucien, in his original papers, showed that particularly the second one, gave a construction that works for all bipartite pure entangled states, except, curiously, for the maximally entangled ones. And Shane showed in his thesis that this is showing that that particular construction doesn't work. Shane showed in his thesis that there's no finite set of measurements which, when used together with the maximally entangled bipartite state, yields a Hardy paradox. And in a more recent work with Carmen Constantin and Shengang Ying, we have the following result. An n-qubit pure state admits measurements for which it's logically contextual, if and only if it cannot be written as a product of one-qubit states and maximally entangled bipartite states. So these are the only exceptional cases. Moreover, in the case that this doesn't apply, the measurements can be computed effectively from the state. We have actually written a program to do that. It obviously doesn't run on a classical program, so it doesn't run on very, but it can go up to about 10 qubits. So that gives a fairly complete picture of when Hardy paradox arguments are available, and they're surprisingly ubiquitous, we might say. Now, strong contextuality, we can ask the same question over again, and it's a considerably more complex story. So we have... So it was already known, using slightly different language, that for two-qubit states, no two-qubit state can achieve strong contextuality with any finite set of measurements. We proved it again, not realizing it had been proved previously, but anyway. So the interesting question is to look at the three-qubit case. And there we were able to use the structure theory of how those of slot classes given by Duovidal and Sirac, which, as you will recall, classifies three qubit states into these eight slot classes, the two maximal ones of the classes of the GHZ and W state, and then those where you have two entangled states and a product with a third, and finally the product state down here. So we already know from the earlier results that none of these are going to be interesting. In fact, we have the result that only states in the GHZ slot class can achieve strong contextuality with any finite set of measurements. In particular, the W state just can't with any finite set of measurements. Moreover, we derive a lot of constraints on the form that the states must have, and we also show that only equatorial measurements are relevant to showing strong contextuality. This is equatorial relevant to the, sorry, relative to the representation of the state. There's a sort of corresponding great circle. If we use the representation of the GHZ class given by Dourvidal and Sirac, and equatorial relative to that are the only measurements that are relevant to the issue of strong contextuality. That's in this paper over here. In particular, so that, of course, we might have the situation where the only thing that would give us strong contextuality with three qubits is the GHZ state itself, or its LU class more broadly, because obviously this is invariant under LU equivalence. But this turns out not to be the case. And actually what we find is a family of tripartite states, all of them in different LU classes within the slot class of GHZ. And the feature they have is that two of the qubits are maximally entangled, and the entanglement with the third decreases as we vary some parameter. So we can define actually a continuous parameter with some angle, so they look like this. Without trying to go into the detail, you can sort of measure by the von Neumann entanglement entropy how entangled the third qubit is with the other two. And at one extreme, you actually just get the GHZ state itself. And at the other extreme, you would get, in the limit, you would get the product state. So they're getting less and less entangled with the two states which are entangled, two qubits which are entangled with each other. And what we find is that if we take the right points along this spectrum, that we can find for the nth term in this family, it's already getting less entangled with the two qubits as a function of n, we can find n measurements for each qubit in the entangled pair and a single measurement for the third qubit, such that the resulting empirical model is strongly contextual. And this is, so we can sort of trade the number of measurements against the degree of entanglement with the third qubit, and we obtain strong contextuality with a finite number of measurements for every member of the family. And this is, there's an interesting contrast with a construction by Barrett, Kent and Peronio, which uses the same kind of measurements on the maximally entangled bipartite state, to never achieving strong contextuality, because we had the earlier result that ruled that out, but achieving strong contextuality in the limit, shrinking the non-contextual fraction, so in the limit it would go to zero. But here, our family of states, which just require weak entanglement with the third qubit, managed to achieve at every point along this sequence full strong contextuality with a finite scenario. And it may be that this can be advantageous in experiments. There have been recent experiments to push up the highest measured values of the contextual fraction, which Shane is going to talk about. Well, he's not going to talk about the experiments, but he's going to talk about the contextual fraction. And they may be advantageous in that regard. So something that interesting that may come out of this. OK, so I'm now going to come to my final topic, which is going to relate to some of the things we heard earlier in various ways. So let me come back to the issue of strong contextuality and give what I'll call a definition of a quantum witness for such a thing. So a quantum witness for strong contextuality of an empirical model is going to be given by a state and some projection-valued measurements, where if measurements occur in the same context, in the same compatible set in our scenario, then they commute. And then we get the probabilities out in the expected fashion. So, for example, we could take the GHZ state with X and Y measurements for each party, and this would give us a standard quantum realization of a strongly contextual model. We can go one step further and ask for a state-independent quantum witness, which would be given by a family of measurements which, for any state, yield a quantum witness. And the Mermin magic square and Cochin-Specker constructions provide examples of state-independent quantum witnesses for strong contextuality. So in the state-independent case, then, it's the measurements themselves that satisfy this relation. So it's a very strong property indeed, and remarkable that it can be fulfilled. What I want to talk about is an interesting recent connection that's recently been developed between state-independent, strong contextuality, non-local games, and quantum homomorphisms. And this is in this recent paper here, which is in appearing in the MFCS conference. So a non-local game is, so we're going to really tie together in a way that's already been mentioned in a different form, I guess, in Adan's talk. We're going to tie together non-local games and state-independent strong contextuality. So a non-local game, we have Alice and Bob cooperating against a verifier. The verifier gives them some inputs and they have to produce some outputs, and we have some winning condition. So we can think of the Mermin magic square as giving a set of equations, mod 2 equations. So this is just another way of writing what we saw earlier in Rob's talk, for example. And of course, those equations are not satisfiable in Z2. Alice and Bob, now the important point is that Alice and Bob can share prior information but cannot communicate once the game starts. So the general idea is verifier sends an equation to Alice and a variable to Bob, and they win if Alice returns a satisfying assignment for the equation and Bob returns a value for the variable consistent with Alice's assignment. And a perfect strategy is one that wins with probability 1. Classically, Alice and Bob have a perfect strategy if and only if there is an honest, satisfying assignment for the equations. Mermin's construction shows that there's a quantum perfect strategy for the magic square. So Alice and Bob can, now these, in various forms, the games for binary constraint systems have been studied by Cleve, Mittal, Liu, William Slofstra. They show that they have a quantum perfect, having a quantum perfect strategy is equivalent to a purely group theoretic condition on a solution group, which can be associated to each system of binary equations. And an outstanding recent result by Slofstra says that every finitely presented group can be embedded in a solution group, which immediately yields as corollaries that there are finite systems of Boolean equations which have quantum perfect strategies in infinite dimensional Hilbert space, but not in any finite dimension, which I think is, as well as the fact that the question of whether something does have a quantum solution is undecidable. So this is an area where there's been exciting progress recently.
So we're interested in looking at a very general setting for looking at these kind of games and then relating it to contextuality. So in computer science and related logical ideas, a fundamental sort of setup is to look at relational structures and homomorphisms between them. So we have a bunch of relation symbols. A relational structure is a set and an interpretation of each relation symbol with a relation on that set, and a homomorphism is a function which preserves the relations. And this is pervasive in logic, in computer science, databases, constraint satisfaction, and also combinatorics, and so forth. And the question is, what could it mean to quantize these fundamental structures? If you do it uniformly, there's a huge range of classical, well-studied notions in classical information processing, which would have a quantum analog. So let's consider the homomorphism game, which is played between finite structures. So Alice and Bob, again, have to cooperate to convince a verifier that there's a homomorphism from A to B. And once again, the idea is that Alice and Bob are not allowed to communicate while the game is being played. In a play of the game, the verifier sends Alice a relation he's interested in and an input tuple in the relation, and Bob an element of the underlying structure. And Alice returns a tuple in the output structure, and Bob returns an element of the output structure. And the winning condition is that, firstly, the output tuple has to be in the right relation in the output structure. So we're fulfilling the homomorphism condition. And also there has to be a consistency condition between Alice and Bob. And you can think of this as a way of ensuring that this compatibility condition, that we don't just cheat and use completely different resources for each context, for each different question that, that we're given, is being enforced. So Bob is keeping Alice honest, as it were. A perfect strategy, again, is one in which they win with probability one. Spell out this consistency condition, if Bob's input coincides with the ith element of Alice's input tuple, then Bob's output has to be the same as the ith element of Alice's output tuple, because after all, we're meant to be giving a function. Homomorphism is a function. And again, if only classical resources are allowed, the existence of a perfect strategy is equivalent to the existence of a homomorphism in the usual sense. Now, what does it mean to play this game with quantum resources? There are going to be finite dimensional Hilbert spaces and a pure state, and Alice can only perform operations on her part of the state, and Bob can only perform operations on his part. Alice will have a POVM for each of these questions she can be asked by the verifier, and similarly Bob will have a POVM where the possible outcomes are corresponding output tuples for Alice and corresponding output elements for Bob. So the way this works is that given her input, Alice measures the corresponding observable on her part of the state, Bob measures his observable on his part, and they obtain this joint outcome with the probability given by the Born rule. And if with probability one, the outcome satisfies the winning conditions, this is a quantum perfect strategy. And if we write it in terms of the quantum operations, so the idea is that the cases where we violate the homomorphism condition should have probability zero, so that gives us this condition here. And the cases where we violate the consistency condition should be probability zero, and that's this condition here. So these two conditions are equivalent to this idea of using the resources to have a perfect strategy. So notice again that there are conditions essentially on the support of the distribution we're generating from these state and observables. So we have the following result, that if we have a quantum perfect strategy at all, remember we were being quite general. I mean, it's actually pretty obvious that although I said pure states, if we take a mixed states, it would make no difference, because you'd write it as any of the pure states, the mixed state was a mixture of, could be used in place. And if the mixed state worked with probability one, so would any of the pure states. But more strikingly, we can always find corresponding projective measurements to use for the measurements for Alice and Bob. And we can always take the state to be a very specific thing, namely the maximally entangled state. And moreover, Alice's measurements if we marginalize to get the corresponding element, are just the transpose of Bob's measurement. Now, you might think, going from POVMs to projectors, that's just dilation. But actually, that's not what's going on at all. The interesting point in this construction is that what's involved in passing to this special form actually reduces the dimension, if anything. We're not going to a larger Hilbert space. We're actually, the process by which we obtain projective measurements here is not at all akin to dilation. And what the theorem shows is that all the information determining the strategy is in Alice's operators. So you see, you could read off Bob's operators from Alice's operators. You could a priori say the state is a maximally entangled state. So if these are completely determined, there's no information in them. All the information is in Alice's operators. But what the consistency condition means is that we can make cross identifications using this coincidence between different contexts. So it tells us that Alice's operators must be chosen non-contextually so that this thing is actually independent of the context in which we're applying it. Although it seemed that Alice had measurements depending on her input from the verifier, actually, there are going to be projectors that she has to use uniformly, determined only by the particular input that she's given in each position in the tuple. This is a generalization, I should say, of results in these papers. I think our proof is a bit more, is closest to this one and considerably simpler. From this, which is a striking reduction of all this apparatus of a game, then we can extract the notion of a quantum homomorphism between relational structures. And it is, so to speak, a projector-valued relation between A and B, satisfying some fairly evident conditions. So what we're saying is that the so we have a local commutation condition here, but the main point is that locally we have to preserve a homomorphism condition. We can never have a tuple which is non-zero, something which gets the truth value one, where the input is a tuple is in a relation and the output tuple isn't. So we have this notion of quantum homomorphism, and we have a complete correspondence between quantum perfect strategies and these quantum homomorphisms. In fact, there's a one-to-one correspondence with those strategies in the particular form that we gave. Now, if coming from the computer science side, where sort of having uniform ways of describing various kinds of computational effects is important, it's a nice observation that we can go one step further and replace this notion of quantum homomorphism with a classical homomorphism to a new structure we build over B, which is, giving us projector-valued distributions on B, essentially. And what this tells us is that this construction is part of a monad on the category of classical structures and homomorphisms. And the quantum homomorphisms are exactly the Kleisley morphisms for this monad. This may be gobbledygook to you, but monads play a major role in programming language theory as encapsulating computational effects. And anyone who's used the Haskell programming language, for example, will have encountered them. So what we get is a nice mathematical formulation of what quantization, in terms of the use of doing something with the use of quantum resources, means for a very broad range of computational tasks. So just as one example, most graph invariants can be described in terms of the minimum sort of size of a clique or something like that to which you have a homomorphism, and such definitions immediately fall out uniformly from this setting. Now, the connection with contextuality is as follows. And this really is a consequence of what we saw, that we could get rid of we could sort of have this correspondence between the apparently non-local situation with the Alice Bob game, and then something that just related to Alice and her measurements. That in fact there's a one-to-one correspondence between state-independent quantum witnesses for a given empirical model and quantum homomorphisms for the corresponding structures that we can derive from these things. So there's a tight connection between state-independent, strong contextuality, a la Koch and Specker, and non-local games, which goes via this notion of quantum homomorphisms. Okay, so just to finish up, we can really capture all the notions that have been discussed previously, where we've and there's also an interesting infinite-dimensional version. Some further questions are, what about state-dependent contextuality? So there isn't a clear, at the moment, the way that non-locality enters in is you didn't really need the state anyway in just to demonstrate the contextuality in one system, say Alice. You were just using this maximally entangled state as a way of keeping Alice and Bob in sync, and therefore adding this consistency condition between context to the setup. So that was the role it was playing. It would be interesting to see if we could also bring state-dependent contextuality into this picture. And of course, we would like to go beyond perfect strategies and to quantify bounds on success probabilities in the non-perfect case. And this is where the quantitative ideas that Shane will be talking about would very naturally play a role. So, a final comment. Contextuality in physics raises deep questions about the nature of reality, but it's also a new kind of resource which yields new possibilities in information processing, and the challenge is to find methods to harness this resource and understand its structures. But also, of course, we would hope to sort of close the circle and by using these notions actually come to understand them better and maybe This will be the only way of understanding them better. And what was underlying all of this, most explicitly in the topological things with the cohomology and so on, is the sort of general idea to understand contextuality as local consistency but global inconsistently. Local consistency in what we can observe directly, because, I mean, what would it mean for it not to be consistent? But on the other hand, the inability to patch these local descriptions together into a global one. When we look at it in that way, we find many, many places, both in classical computation and in a range of other subjects, where the same notions apply. So that could be another benefit of generating a general theory. And using constructions such as the ones we've discussed provides a systematic means of quantizing classical computational tasks in a structural way. So I'll finish there. Thank you very much. Yes.
So would it be fair to say that contextuality, like visualized this way, is equivalent to the classical marginal problem?
The classical
marginal problem.
It's certainly related to the classical marginal problem.
It's not
yes.
Equivalent?
If
I'm just thinking of probability distributions.
Yeah.
Then.
Yes. If you're thinking of probability distributions, it's closely related to that.
Right.
Yes.
Right.
And there, by the way, there's an interesting point there because there's a result about the marginal problem due to Vorobyov, which was motivated by game theory, cooperative game theory, which characterizes combinatorially those what we call measurement scenarios, essentially simplicial complexes, for which you can always glue local information together to get globally consistent information. And you can actually apply this back to the issue of conditions under which you won't see contextuality and why in macroscopic...
So it's a complete characterization?
It's a complete characterization, yes.
Oh.
Yes. But of course, this is a very strong condition. So it's an acyclicity condition. It's saying that. So we can discuss it afterwards. But yeah, but it is. There's interesting connections. Yes.
You mentioned about this Slofstra result, right?
Yes.
My question is, it kind of looks impossible intuitively, but it's kind of true. So.
This was the family of states, just to clarify. Is that what you're referring
to? No, this question was the games that are, you can win only in infinite dimensions, right?
Yes.
So the question is, you have finite, there are finite settings there, and how many outcomes?
These are Boolean things.
These are Boolean things?
Yes. It's remarkable.
And finite number of observables.
Finite number of equations and variables, yes.
Okay, so it sounds...
And you can only win in infinite dimensions. It's a remarkable result.
That's remarkable, yeah.
We may even hear about it. I don't know.
Tomorrow.
Yeah.
Okay, good. And the second question about your result about Hardy.
Yes.
So how many settings you had in the...
Very good point. So to extend this to n qubits, where you're not in the exceptional case, you actually just need n plus 2 settings. So basically you have a Hardy construction in two of the qubits, and you have a suitable measurement in each of the other parties.
All right. So it gives you 2 per each, right?
Yeah.
Because it seems, that if you go to higher dimensions and more settings...
Yes.
Then you may have Hardy paradox on maximal entanglement state.
Yeah, you're talking about going beyond qubits.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
Beyond qubits, but I see. Okay,
yeah,
thanks.
No. I agree. I mean, and we haven't. Okay. We haven't really explored that, but I agree. It would be an interesting, absolutely, a very interesting thing to do.
I think we found some interesting.
Oh, okay. Well, yeah. I'd like to hear about that. Yes, thanks.
This this non-existence of a global section.
Yes.
Well, it's always seemed to me, although I haven't tried to follow it up, that what goes on as you go around one of these constructions, you don't come back to the same value.
Exactly, yes.
That this must be connected to something quite different, and that is holonomy. That is to say, the geometric or berry phase that exactly this goes on with the berry phase, and this is a, so to speak, a sort of discrete version of the berry phase, and I have a feeling that this is something that should be pushed, but I'm not doing it. But do you know of any work on, you know, connecting it up with what physicists call holonomy and mathematicians call anti-holonomy? You know, I mean, in complex variables, you when you do a continuation of let's say the square root of z, as you move around, you get a continuous thing. But when you come back, it's not getting the same value. That's why you form a Riemann surface to separate it.
Yes.
But that's the non-holonomy that mathematicians talk about. And that exists in the berry phase. And I'm sure it's the same thing as goes on in this KS construction. But I don't know if anybody has followed this up.
Right. Well, I mean, as it happens, we did think a little bit about that without pursuing it very far. I mean, I think it is very interesting. What is true is that recently people have been using some of these topological methods in combinatorics, so they haven't been looking at discrete versions of these.
I have a feeling somebody who's a distinguished physicist here from Princeton, Paul Dane, I should talk to him, perhaps. He does. Uh-huh. This is what his work is in this topological quantum theory. So
right.
It seems to me that that's really what's going on here.
Right. Well. Perhaps we can talk about it afterwards. But yes, I think there's potentially a lot of stuff here that one could get hold of in this way, and it could be very fruitful to do so.
Any more questions?
Okay. This is probably a stupid question, but you had these connections between contextuality and the existence of quantum homomorphisms.
Yes.
So recently, some of these authors that you cited, they found the existence of quantum isomorphisms.
Yes.
Does this extra structure buy you anything, or?
So the notion of quantum isomorphism is interesting from this point of view. If you're because it's not an isomorphism in the category I was describing. There's an additional subtlety there.
So I think you took it from the graph and then you lifted it to whatever you needed.
Yes,
that was your generalization.
Yes, that's
right. So if you did the same thing with isomorphism,
well,
does that even make sense?
I think there is something one can do there, but
not quite so obvious.
The general idea of taking these apparently symmetrical things and understanding them as monads or comonads is actually interesting also from even in classical computation as well. And similar questions arise there. So I think that's something we're looking at, but we'd like to understand it better.
Okay, I think we should leave it there to have time for the coffee break. So let's thank Samson again.